to the Creative Pen Podcasts. I'm Joanna Penn, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options, internet sales and promotion for your book. The companion website is www.thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com, and today I'm here with Matt Gartland. Matt is an editor for Indie Authors, a freelance editorial strategist, and an independent business consultant. His site, winningedits.com, offers great advice for indies as well as providing editing services. So welcome, Matt.
Thank you for having me, Joanna. This is such a pleasure.
No, it's great to have you on the show. So why don't you start off by telling us a bit more about you and about your business?
Excellent. So as you say, Winning Edits is my digital home, and I have devoted the site, both in terms of the content and the editorial services, to the indie author in trying to help them win their readers' hearts and minds. And just that hearts and mind concept, I think, is so powerful, especially today where authors have an ability through their author platform, through their social network channels, to really connect at a very deeper level and make a really lasting impact. And the book as a vehicle for that is still so powerful as a part of that. So that's what I try to address. The editing, though, just sort of my personality, and I think also very important right now in the universe of books, is very no-nonsense. It's very direct. It's very compassionate, but very just insightful and usable and even tactical, so that ultimately the indie author is left with a really professional edit, a professional sort of manifestation of what their original idea was, and gets kind of out of the amateurish mistakes that I think unfortunately have sort of pervaded what the indie stereotype is, or what the self-published stereotype is. So I really then try to focus working with those authors that are of a certain, say, psychographic, you know, the folks that really gel well with me and that we're just a really strong partnership, are those that are, you know, really dedicated to detail, that hold themselves to high standards, you know, themselves as well as me. And we are just really devoted to sort of those professional ethos.
No, that's marvelous. And you said a few things there, so we'll delve into that a bit more.
Yes,
first, excellent. First of all, I did actually want to re-emphasize again to anyone who's listening. Now, I am personally a massive fan of editors. I think they are critical. I don't think we as authors can see the mistakes sometimes. But even this weekend, I was teaching a group of authors and somebody said, oh, do I really need an editor? And I said, well, I think you definitely do. And of course, you are an editor, so you have a vested interest. But what is the difference between a book, you know, somebody who, let's just say, is a good writer, you know, so let's just say that they're a good writer, but what's the difference between their book without an editor and their book with an editor?
Sure. Well, I'll say first that I think the authors should try to do a certain amount of editing on their own. And we can talk about the value of first drafts and other things maybe. I think that handing off just a first draft to an editor is a dangerous business on both sides. And I think that there's more positive endgame, again, for both if there's more due diligence put up front with the author. Ultimately, a good editor can't save a poor book or bad writing, and you know, different kind of permutations on that quote, which I think is more sort of it's not an attributable quote anymore. I think it's just almost a part of the lexicon of writing and editing. The difference, I think, is that there's a greater weight to a professionally edited book. I think that the story arcs have more weight, more gravity to them, whether they be self-identical characteristics in characters, if we're talking about a fiction book, or the sequence of kind of argumentation if it's a nonfiction book. I mean, massive examples, but say Malcolm Gladwell's books, right? Nonfiction, but there's such a weight to them, right, with the stories and the examples. Obviously not an indie author, but just as sort of a book with a lot of weight to it. I think that on the backside when it comes to, again, an author platform, when it comes to where the book fits into then an indie author's business, whatever that is. I think that the professional approach to maturing the concepts, the language of the book, making sure that there aren't just a lot of kind of dead zones, right, in a certain text that can be blind spots quite often. As you say, it's really hard, even if an editor is writing, and I write as well, you're just so within the white space of the text that that's where kind of the gremlins live, whether they be grammar mistakes or point of view mishaps or just developmental tangents that go off kind of as split ends and they sort of never come back. And that's where having a professional editor sort of then takes the book to the next level.
Mm. And so you mentioned first drafts there. Let's come back to that. So
yes.
Why should you, so, you know, what's the difference between a first draft and what somebody would give to an editor?
Certainly. So I have borrowed from Neil Gaiman's sort of point of view on first drafts. I've tried to read and watch as many interviews as I can with him. Marvelous writer. And he has said that first drafts don't matter, just very frankly, that... And it's a continuing challenge for everyone, even himself. He says something to the effect of, for himself, it's a consistent struggle just to convince himself that the first drafts don't matter, to just get the words on the page.
Yep.
That to get out of the kind of the self-editing writer's block, whatever you want to call it, you need to just take what in your head are, you know, non-sequential, creative, you know, very kind of right brain concepts, get them onto the page and not worry about all of them, the other side of the brain, you know, analytical, logical, refining sort of stuff. It's very much a different mindset, a different creative sort of engagement with talent and with words. So the first draft is just a vehicle to then the better draft, second draft and to the third. I don't think there's ever a set number to say, you know, don't hand off until, you know, the third or the fifth draft, but certainly not the first, because it's just, maybe this is a bit too broad to say, but, you know, it's a brainstorming, and you need to get it down there, you need to start playing with it, and, you know, that's, it just, things come out differently when you do that on paper, rather than just playing with it in your head, and you have more experience at this than I do, being an author. I write, but I don't have a novel yet, but I do want to, and I have scraps of things, and I certainly will be investing heavily in an editor to help me mature my drafts.
Yeah, no, that's great. And for me, I actually really struggle with the first draft. I'm in the first draft right now for my third novel, Exodus, in the Arcane series. And I really struggle just with, or like you said, all the creative stuff that's in your head and actually trying to get the words on the page, knowing that actually these words are pretty bad, but at least you know that no one's going to see them. And then, of course, I would never dream of, and for people listening, you know, we pay editors. Indies pay editors. You're not doing it for fun. You know, well, you like it too, right?
But well, it is fun.
It is fun.
Thankfully, it's a marriage of the two. So,
but also you have to, as an author, you have to pay an editor, well, as an indie. So it's very important that you're paying somebody at the point where the book is as good as you can make it. Without, you know, if you can't go any further, that's when you get an editor. That's what I think.
Yeah, that's a marvelous point. I have, you know, turn down business, not out of disrespect, but out of, I don't think this is ready yet. I don't think that your ideas on your own have matured enough. I don't think that maybe you've advanced the manuscript on your own enough, that I am just receiving a first draft. And, you know, it's hard. It's sort of this, how can I help someone? I don't think I can help them the best that I can right now, just because it is a bit too raw. And so I've kind of given that feedback, because you do want it. I want it to be a very fulfilling experience. And ultimately, an editor can't guarantee the success of a book. Mm. But the attitude that I bring to my projects and to my business is that I want to make sure that, to the best degree possible, I am providing a quality experience that has an opportunity for high return on investment. And if I don't think that that's there, I'll give that feedback. Either find maybe another editor that's cheaper, or just spend more time on your own. Rewriting, the value of rewriting is priceless, as well as then find some beta authors, or rather beta readers on your own to maybe get some initial feedback to help you before, as you say, you find that opportunity, that sort of inflection point where, yes, now I need a professional editor.
Yeah, no, that's great. And you mentioned beta readers there, and I used the term as well. Yes. And then someone picked me up on it this weekend and went, excuse me, what is a beta reader? So what do you define as a beta reader?
I think that they are unabashed friends and family. So, and I say that in, purposefully. So you need to have someone that won't pull punches. And I think typically those are those folks, friends and family, they're going to be in your inner circle that really want you to succeed so much that they're going to be brutally honest. I think that a good editor operates the same way, that a good editor is a partnership. It's, you know, as equals, and the editor has a vested relationship in that experience, wants you to win, and so won't pull punches. The value of beta readers is typically they're free, you know, friends and family. They want you to win and succeed so much that they'll put in the time, they'll write you really long responses in email, or they'll type it up in Word. And that is invaluable from at least an initial kind of proof of concept, if you kind of maybe want to talk, you know, almost as these as business products, where, hey, is this a good story, right? So to kind of overcome some of the initial, you know, boulders over our head, or for writers' heads, where is this a good story to tell or is it not? You know, do I have the ability to do this, or is it not there? Is the chemistry, is the magic of the characters or of the plot line not there? I think that's where beta readers can really help overcome these initial obstacle blocks.
So I would say something different for beta readers. I actually think, like, my husband, who's very supportive of my writing world, is not a fan of the type of books that I write, and neither is my mom or my dad, or in fact any of my family. So I would say that actually the most important criteria for a beta reader is someone who's a fan of the genre that you write. So because then they can actually evaluate, you know, what I'm doing. So if I wrote historical fiction, my mum would actually be good, but she just doesn't like the type of stuff I write. So right. I think when people, and when I first started, it was friends. So it was friends who literally liked the genre. But now I have a network of other writers. So I would also urge people listening to just kind of network like we do. And we met on Twitter, and now we look at each other's blogs and things. And, you know, this is how you create relationships. So I would urge people to kind of pick up friends who are authors in the genre and see if you can swap beta reads.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And for those that already have a digital platform, however small, even if you have one and you even have 50 followers on Twitter or just 10 readers of your blog, that's something. And to your point, those are already individuals that are vested in your niche or genre or whatever. And tapping into that is the best of both worlds, where they want to see you succeed tremendously. So will be, or at least they have a high probability of being very blunt and brutally honest, which is very valuable. Yep. And they love your work. So that is the best of all worlds.
So. Fantastic. So I wanted to, you mentioned return on investment there, which I really liked, because you're one of the editors that I recommend, and a number of the editors I recommend have higher prices and others have lower prices, and people have different ways of editing. So when you talk about return on investment, what do you mean for an author, and how should they evaluate the cost versus the return?
Yes, it's a big question, and there's a lot of moving parts. I know in the guest article I wrote for your site, which is very kind, we got into some good conversation in the comments, if folks and listeners want to go back and kind of see that. Because it is, I think, you know, it's a weighty proposition for indie authors that by and large are, you know, going alone on this. There's a lot of upsides that you have the empowerment to choose the folks on your team that you want, whether that's an editor, a publicist, a cover designer, right? You are empowered, and that's the beauty and the amazing side of the publication revolution, is that you can make your own team. And you can control your own destiny. But you do need to have a business savvy mind enough that you're engaging at the right point. So so return on investment, absolutely. I think, again, you need to have your story pretty well developed. It can't be just what you wrote over the weekend. Certainly through a couple first drafts or a couple just initial drafts, maybe a pass or two through your beta readers. At that point, to get the optimal return on investment from an editor standpoint, you need to be like, okay, ready. I can use this, and I can use this almost immediately, right? I can use this. I have my platform ready to go. I have maybe a series already out, and you know, in the rise sort of serial fiction or just serial content through books is now growing quite quickly and quite pervasively. So I think a good sort of trigger, or maybe there's a couple triggers here, from a return on investment standpoint for an editor is, because typically an editor is going to come in towards the end of your project, and you know, you don't want then to have your book professionally edited and then it just sits on the proverbial shelf. So I think you need to have sort of a distribution plan, you know, whether that's just going into the Kindle store or whether you want to then actually take your book and try to then still take it to a traditional publishing house. And if I can tangent off of this quickly, what I think is fascinating, I have not personally yet worked with an author of this type or with this intent, but I've certainly heard a lot of stories where people will now go out, get their own independent editors, they're still an indie author, go through the process of developing their book, so it's fantastic, but then they don't self-publish. They then try to then take this thing that is light years better than they could have ever done just in their own, you know, studio, in their own office, and then they still take it and try to get a traditional deal, which is fantastic if you want to do that. The point here is that you have that next step ready so that it just doesn't wait, because otherwise there is the potential that you've sunk a lot of time and money into this, and you're just not going to receive any sort of return on the next step.
Yeah, and I agree with all of that, and I would take it even further and say that the books that have been edited do better in the Kindle store. So, you know, people will actually, in terms of anybody can get a top ranking by trying really hard on launch,
right,
but then it will sink out of trace if the book is no good. Whereas if the book is good and it's been edited, I think it will get more reviews and it will sell more and people will actually make money. So so I always say to people, well, look, you know, for an indie, you do have to pay some money up front for an editor, for a cover designer. Those two, for me, are non-negotiable. And
right,
then you will get money from that, but it is a bit later. So you have to kind of think, you know, in a slightly different order.
Yes, it's kind of Seth Godin's long tail, right? You're putting out artifacts that, if they are good, they will stick. They'll have permanence through time. And like yourself, you write in a series, and I'm just fascinated with series development. I'm a huge Downton Abbey fan, for example.
Yeah.
I know that's a television series, but there's a lot of corollary, I think. I wrote an article for Copyblogger that sort of is an examination of how Downton Abbey works so amazingly well around storytelling and what we as writers and sort of implied even as editors can do to kind of bring those qualities into the books that we write. And it is that sort of serialized nature. If they are really good, they will work. It adds that certainly professionalism, that reputation. And that's a big thing even for me in sort of the branding with Winning Edits, is that while we can't guarantee a certain amount of monetary success, we can certainly guarantee a professional ethos, a professional reputation. Trying to, again, shift, at least for you, and redefine what it means to be labeled as an indie author, a self-publisher, that it's not just hobbyists, we're not just amateurs. And it's okay to be those things, too. It's not a knock against those. But if you really want to have a writing career and make money off of your words and enjoy that lifestyle, then I think you do need to hold yourself to that higher standard.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's talk about a bit more nitty gritty.
Yes, please. Oh my goodness.
What are a couple of the worst mistakes that indie, or in fact all authors, probably make over and over again?
Sure. That's a good question. There's a lot of nitty gritty in the grammar, so we won't turn this into a grammar podcast. We'll leave that for Grammar Girl. I think the the opening is so important. And I've read a lot of books, traditionally published and not, that have really indecisive openings, that they're either slow or they're muted or they're timid. And I think, it's, again, especially now in the digital universe where you can really target in on your ideal reader, you need to set the terms, whether they be the language terms, how you write. Are you going to use profanity? Is it going to be kind of a dark story? You need to set those up front so that you don't allow a reader to kind of get into a story that's a bit vanilla, again, fiction or non, and then all of a sudden in chapter three, you sort of reveal that, oh, this is a dark story, or I'm going to, you know, cuss every other line and things like that, and then they're going to be caught off guard. So there's sort of that so that the reader is not taken, sort of taken for a ride, right, and not really clicking with the ultimate kind of story arcs or the tension of the narrative. Also, you need to start building momentum early, is sort of my opinion. And whether that manifests as a really kind of tantalizing prologue in a fiction sense, and Game of Thrones prologues are a great example of this. The prologue of the first Aragorn book was phenomenal. I'm a big fiction guy, or fantasy guy, I should say. In even the Harry Potter books, I know I'm quoting massive examples, they didn't have prologues, but all the first chapters were just, wow, like you got started with a bang. And I think that a lot of folks, especially for sort of maybe a first time or a second time indie author, there's that sort of timidity there that, you know, I just need to get into this, and that's okay. But I think a much better job is trying to just launch with a bang. Other things, my goodness. I think just having the narrative present high stakes, I guess it's of a similar quality of what I just said around not being too timid. I think that, and I wrote about this in relation to the Downton Abbey example again, is that there's just really authentic characters that are put in really high stakes situations. And that then creates automatic drama, right? You need that to have the self-identifiable characteristics for the reader to kind of just fall into this and get lost in the words and then move forward. And I've read just a lot of really good stories. They have the potential, but it's the stakes aren't high enough. You know, there's not enough drama going on. And all of this is certainly, again, angled, I suppose, towards fiction. But I think even in nonfiction, if you're writing, or if you really want to write a persuasive nonfiction book with a really strong central argument, you need to really illustrate in a lot of creative ways, not logical, but certainly more emotional, what those stakes are. And, you know, it's sort of sad for me as an editor, but certainly as a bookworm and as an ardent reader, first and foremost, to get into a book that has such potential and it just doesn't live up to it. So.
No, fair enough. Now, people ask me, you know, how do I find an editor that I gel with? So, I mean, how do you identify that? How do you identify clients who fit with you? And how can authors find editors that will work with their specific type of book?
It's an ongoing struggle, I think, on both sides, quite frankly. And part maybe because the industry is changing and all of that. I think there's some tried and true basics. Word of mouth more than ever is really important. Most of, I'll admit, the clients I'm getting now, or at least those that really click, as you say, are of the word of mouth variety because there's a built-in kind of filter there. So if you have a writing group or a book group that you go to, that you share common passions and favorite genres and things like that, then I would heavily rely on them first to try to get some recommendations. You have amassed personally a great list of other editors on your editor page, and obviously honored to be on that page. So I think if there are examples like yourself and others that have done a certain amount of curation that you can trust and rely on, then you know, I would, you know, go there as well. When you start to engage, ask a lot of pointed questions up front. If someone comes to me, just kind of play that backwards, and they're not asking a lot of questions, and not just about cost, but about process. What does the engagement look like? What does it feel like? What is editing? So many people don't understand that there's gradients of editing. There's developmental editing or structural editing, kind of the same thing. There's line editing and copy editing. Sometimes people consider those the same. I split them out. If people aren't asking those questions, because it's not an everyday thing that you may know, then that's sort of a red flag to me that, oh, they're not invested, I think, in what it means to be edited. And it's not a knock or a criticism per se. I don't think that they're ready. I think that they're still sort of early in their maturation of what it means to write and be edited and produce a book. So ask really sharp questions. I am working now with a client that she apologized. Like, one of her first lines in her email was, "This is just who I am. I'm going to ask a lot of questions." And it was like 12 to 20 questions of just really good stuff. Who am I as a person? What books do I read? You know?
Yeah.
And I think that's really important for writers to understand their editor. What do they read? What do they like? What do they feel is a good book? What do they feel isn't? Just get to know them at a personal level too. And I think that's advice that can't go wrong.
So even if someone has picked you as an editor and you've established a nice relationship and everything, there is a moment when, of course, you give back feedback and either a report on their writing or line edits. And having had both from editors, in fact, I once got an email from one of my editors, and I waited 10 days before I opened the email because I was so scared of what it was going to say. And essentially, as authors, we are paying for an editor to do the job of critique and making our work better. But it hurts, you know, it hurts.
Yeah. it's a bit weird like that, right? Maybe take it too far and poke fun at my own industry, but you're kind of paying for punishment, right?
Exactly. And I wondered if you could maybe talk a bit about when you critique things, when you red pen whole pages, why are you doing that? And it's not like a personal attack, is it?
Right. So one approach that I take, because the editing that I provide is holistic editing. I do developmental all the way through copy editing. The first deliverable that I produce is the developmental editing report, which is a standalone document. So it's not the line editing, inline track changes. There's blood red, you know, all over the page. And I think that has proven to me very helpful to then, especially certainly with writers that have never been edited, starts to get them in the mindset of change and starts to then prep them for what's to come, where my developmental edit is broken down into, you know, the introduction, show versus tell, which is a continuing struggle. That's another one of, you know, a common sort of thing that I've discovered. Too many authors just telling me what's going on. Jill was sad. Johnny was mad, you know, that sort of stuff, rather than using the emotional language. So I do that. It's very structured. There's like call to actions at the end of every point, like recommendations that either the writer can then apply before I start line editing or that I will apply in my line edit. So it starts to digest. It's sort of like inception, right? It starts to plant the seed for what the changes to come so that they're not shocked when they get a developmental editing, or I'm sorry, when they get a line editing back with the copy and the line changes in there. And it's like, what the heck is this, right? That's, I guess, one point. The second is, as editors, you need to show a lot of compassion and you need to lay that groundwork up front. You need to say, rewriting is a very natural and very good thing. That part of the rewriting process is the editing. You will need to do some of the heavy lifting as well. It's a partnership here. It's not just a transaction. At least that's not my philosophy. And you need to then sort of highlight then what is good with what doesn't work. And I think that balance is really important. You've done this really well. Use examples. Like, I can't tell you how many times, and then for the writers and the authors listening to this, make sure that, you know, early on, you know, you're looking to make sure that your editor is using examples in their feedback. It's not just, hey, you need to do more showing rather than telling. Like, that's not all that useful unless, you know, he or she, the editor, is extracting examples, passages from the text to say, you do this really well here. See how this works? So it's sort of a teaching experience as well. And if you're not being taught, if there aren't examples, then I think that's a red flag that maybe it's not a good partnership.
No, that's fantastic. And I think editing is a lot about learning. And I think that the first edits I got on my first book the mistakes I was making then. I think I've almost now, I learned from those, and now I'm making new mistakes.
Which is fine, because you're kind of the failing forward, right, analogy, which is priceless. Neil Gaiman, to quote him again, I love Neil Gaiman, just delivered a fantastic commencement address, and I'm forgetting the university, but it was a video that's kind of gone crazy online over the last week, and he just talks about all through his writing career just failing here, there, and the other, and that's perfectly fine, and he does it so more eloquently than I am, but it's very necessary, I think, to the craft of writing and rewriting, because language itself is an organic thing, and it's not static. The pages of history prove that point. I still happen to be a fan of Old English, and in fact, a lot of British colloquialisms and everything, Downton Abbey and the like. But language is never static, and the only way to understand your own language is to experiment and fail and learn and then move forward.
Absolutely. Right. Well, we are out of time, so why don't you tell
my goodness,
people?
Really?
Yeah. Why don't you tell people where they can find you?
WinningEdits.com is my digital haven and my digital home. So please check me out there. Jonah, you were kind enough to do an interview for my site, so you can find that there as well. And a lot of other great authors and just book people I've had the pleasure of interviewing, and there's just other good articles. And then at Matt Gartland on Twitter is my primary social networking hangout. My last name has a T in it, G-A-R-T. L-A-N-D. The T often doesn't get a lot of love, but that's okay. So thank you, Jonah.
No, well, thanks very much for coming on the show, and I'm pretty sure people will be checking out your site.
Yes, thank you. Have a marvelous day.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You can get more information on writing, publishing options, sales, and promotion for your book at www.thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with double N. And you can also get your free How to Be an Author workbook at www.howtobeanauthor.com. See you next time!